Why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim. دين الإسلام ديني والعظم غير ديني محمد اللي هديني.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the laws of divorce according to Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ishraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Hilli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Hilli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, we are talking about the laws of divorce according to Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas. In one of the earlier programs or episodes of this program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio, you promised us, in fact, to talk about different types of divorce. I remember that you've been talking about revocable as well as irrevocable divorces. Would you touch on that issue and elaborate on it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there are two kinds of divorce, okay? One is revocable divorce, which is called raj'i talaq, and the other one is irrevocable divorce, which is called talaq ghayr raj'i or non-raj'i divorce.
Yes.
Raj'i means, it comes from ruju, and ruju means return. Return means to take back one's wife, okay?
Yes.
Now, in a revocable divorce, of course, the husband has the right to get back to his wife and take her back and actually rejoin or reunite with his wife within the waiting period, which is 3 months or 3 months, okay? But in an irrevocable divorce, of course, the husband is denied the right to do so. He does not have the right to get back to his wife. Now, there are different types of irrevocable divorce, or maybe there are different kinds of irrevocable divorce. First of all, if a person divorces, now this is one of the those irrevocable divorce, if a person divorces his wife who with whom he has never had any physical intimacy or intercourse, this divorce is considered to be irrevocable divorce. Yes, the divorce of a woman who with whom the husband has never had any physical intimacy. Yes, this is one. The second one is when a woman, when a husband divorces his wife who has not attained puberty. Like, for example, a woman, a girl who has not completed 9 lunar years, okay? If the husband divorces her, then then he cannot take her back. There is no idda as well, because there hasn't been any sexual intercourse, okay? Idda is not there.
Sorry, Sheikh, would their marriage be valid?
This is a controversial
question. Because they are underage.
Yeah, of course. We should not... this is a challenging question. Of course, theoretically speaking, the marriage is valid, you know? The marriage is valid. But it's a sensitive question. I think let's just bypass this question.
Okay,
and
fine.
move on to the
right.
Next yes question. Okay. Then we have... talaq khul, or the khul divorce, okay? Khul divorce, I think we discussed this kind of divorce because a khul divorce is a divorce in which the wife develops aversion, hate, or hatred towards her husband, and it is the wife who applies for divorce, and of course the husband has the right to choose whether to divorce his wife or not to divorce his wife. In the event that he divorces his wife, then there is no idda. There is idda, of course. But the husband cannot get back to his wife during the idda period. Because generally speaking, every husband can get back to his wife during the idda period. But when it comes to a wife who has been divorced on the basis of khula divorce, the husband cannot get back to his wife, even though there is idda, waiting period is there. And of course, there are other obligations. Like, for example, in the period of idda, the wife does not need her husband's permission to leave the house. There is no nafaqa. The wife is not supposed to be supported financially by her husband when the divorce is irrevocable. And then we have another type of divorce which is called mubarat, okay, or mubarat divorce. This kind of divorce is a divorce in which both the husband and the wife hate each other. They do not want to stay in the marriage. Both of them wish to separate from each other. This is called mutual hatred, okay? And in this kind of divorce, of course, again, this is one of the irrevocable
divorces.
And then we have triple divorce, when a husband divorces his wife for a third time, then he cannot get back to his wife. He cannot take back his wife during the idda period, unless the wife actually marries another man. And then that man actually divorces her, who is called Muhallil. That man is called Muhallil. Maybe he will divorce or he will not divorce. But if he happens to divorce that woman, then the first husband can remarry.
Uh-huh.
Not get back. Remarry that woman. Remarry that woman.
I see.
Because there's no idda in that case.
I see.
So these are some of the examples of, you see, irrevocable divorce. But there's also another kind of divorce, which is a divorce carried out by a religious authority. A divorce is called, this is also, according to some scholars, considered to be a kind of irrevocable divorce.
So many types of irrevocable divorces, yes, of course, Sheikh Javid. But what about the revocable divorces? Do we have any typology for that too?
Only one revocable.
Only one.
Talaq, raj'i, there's only one kind of revocable divorce.
I see.
Okay.
Okay.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
What if a man wants to get back to his wife who has been divorced for a third time? Is it possible?
I think we discussed it. It's not
only for muhallel to come in,
yeah,
right?
If there is a muhallel, if there is someone in the middle getting married to that woman, and then he divorces that woman, then of course it's possible. And of course that marriage should be permanent.
Mm-hmm.
It cannot be a temporary marriage.
I see.
And a muhallil cannot marry a woman on temporary marriage contract or basis. Yes.
Okay. In the case of an irrevocable divorce, Sheikh Javid, does the wife remain mahram to her husband during the Iddah period? Or
No. The wife, unlike the revocable divorce, in the irrevocable divorce, the wife is no longer mahram to her husband.
Mm-hmm. But in the revocable divorce,
of course, she's mahram. Uh-huh. Yes, okay. She's her husband's wife, and she must get her his permission. She must be supported financially by her husband. Yes,
I see. What about nafaqa and the prohibition of leaving her husband's house without her husband's permission? Are those rules still applicable?
I'm saying it again that these rules are not applicable.
Mm-hmm.
to a woman who has been divorced based on irrevocable divorce, on mm-hmm. raj'i divorce. So, first of all, the wife is not mahram to her husband, the wife, even though she is in her iddah.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's not obligatory for the husband to provide his wife for her food, clothing, and other daily expenses, and of course she can leave her house without having to obtain permission from her husband. These are some of the issues which must be taken into
account. But again, in the case of an irrevocable divorce, what if the woman is pregnant?
Okay, if the woman is pregnant, she remains non-mahram to
mm-hmm.
non-mahram to her husband.
Right.
But it is necessary for the husband to support that woman who is pregnant. He has to bear the expenses because the child is actually his child.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and until and unless she gives birth to the child, the husband must continue to provide for the woman's food and medical expenses or whatever expenditures that she might bear.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And she must be supported financially in that case.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim, Mannan Kareem, Salam Alim, La ilaha illa hu, Ghaffar Jameel, Wahhab Latif, Tawwab Samee, Basir.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tens of thousands of people in France, the UK, Italy, and Greece protested against coronavirus restrictions and mandatory vaccination policies, sparking clashes with police forces. The European governments tried to force more unvaccinated people to receive their coronavirus shots by using sanctions. In France, nearly 160,000 people held nationwide protests against the implementation of a health pass by President Emmanuel Macron's government. Demonstrators slammed this policy by saying it's an attack on their liberty. Macron's health pass will ban access to restaurants and public spaces for unvaccinated people. During the rallies, tensions flared up as French anti-riot police fired tear gas toward protesters and used water cannons to disperse them. Several demonstrators have also been arrested. Elsewhere in Europe, thousands of Italians took to the streets of Rome, Naples, and Turin against the government's introduction of restrictions on unvaccinated people. Protesters chanted slogans such as "Freedom" and "Down with the dictatorship" over plans for a government certificate known as the Green Pass. The Green Pass is an extension of the EU's digital COVID certificate and will be required from August 6th to enter cinemas, museums, indoor swimming pools, or sports stadiums, or eat indoors at restaurants. Thousands of people have also protested in London against what they describe as an erosion of their civil liberties. Demonstrators denounced the UK government's track and trace app, saying it limits their movements. Over 600,000 people are told to self-isolate in 1 week alone this month. The protests come a week after most coronavirus restrictions in England were lifted. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse more than 4,000 people who had gathered in central Athens to protest against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police sources claim that some protesters had thrown petrol bombs, prompting the police to respond with tear gas.
Certainly the lockdowns are making people unhappy. They're driving up unemployment. They're adding to general restlessness. But the problem is broader. I mean, I think people are upset about the poor economy, which is and slow economic growth, which is now in its 13th or 14th year.
Tens of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets and called for the impeachment of President Bolsonaro, who is facing increasing pressure as the pandemic exacts a devastating toll. The South American nation has been grappling with the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States, with over 500,000 deaths. Demonstrators and police scuffled in Sao Paulo, with the smoke rising from tear gas canisters and flashbangs exploding. Bolsonaro has seen his popularity declining amid a Senate probe into corruption scandals tied to the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. His approval rating is at a low record of 24%. Bolsonaro has been famously dismissive of the health crisis, the need to wear face masks, and lockdown measures to halt the spread of the virus. In Australia, protesters carried signs and banners reading, "Wake up Australia," and "Drain the Swamp." Demonstrators defied a month-long stay-at-home order by participating in the unauthorized march in Sydney. Nearly 60 attendees were arrested. Demonstrators clashed with police officers and threw projectiles at them. Authorities suggested that the COVID-related restrictions could remain in place until October.
People have lost faith in the political classes. They don't believe that the politicians in charge know what they're doing. They are quite angry and upset.
In many countries, anti-lockdown anger has merged with other grievances. Demonstrators criticize governments for suspending their right to protest because of the public health crisis. In addition, economic hardship and anxiety have further fueled public anger. According to a multi-agency United Nations report published last week, world hunger and malnutrition levels worsened dramatically last year, with most of the increase likely due to the coronavirus pandemic. The report said nearly 768 million people across the globe were undernourished in 2020, as the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted economies, job markets, and supply chains, as well as inflated food prices. The increase last year was equal to that of the previous 5 years combined. According to the report published by UN agencies including the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, and the World Health Organization, Asia accounts for over half of all undernourished people globally, while Africa experienced the biggest spike. The report says more than 149 million children under 5 are estimated to be afflicted with stunted growth. That means their brains and bodies do not grow to their full potential. Also, children who suffer from chronic hunger are more likely to die before reaching maturity. However, food insecurity was already spreading across the globe before the pandemic due to the conflicts, economic recessions, and climate change. That's why nearly all low- and mid-income countries have experienced economic downturns in 2020. Low-income countries are more vulnerable to food price shocks in particular. While a surge in consumer food price inflation predates the pandemic, early lockdown measures and supply chain disruptions induced a spike in the prices. Also, higher transport costs increased consumer food inflation. Some experts believe that food scarcity will probably trigger social unrest and bring people out into the streets, which is likely to make the next few months unstable.
Well, I think that we have to understand that the food problem is not simply a result of the COVID problem, but it's also a profound problem as a result of climate change.
2020 posed a serious blow to food security around the world, and the effects of the pandemic are expected to linger. In 2030, an estimated 30 million more people may face hunger than would have without the COVID-19 outbreak. Many factors affect food security around the world. Therefore, a food system approach is required to find effective solutions. A report by the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World has recommended a number of actions to help prevent undernourishment. Those include increasing resiliency to conflict, climate change, and economic shocks, and sustainably ensuring access to affordable, nutritious food.
What we have to understand and what we should, as a society, be doing is encouraging increasing local trading systems and community-supported farming organizations such as those that exist around the world. It's called community-supporting agriculture. And they're very, very important because they provide a counterbalance to the increasing control and the lack of diversity that the large corporations are offering.
Food insecurity has been on the rise since the mid-2010s, especially in countries affected by conflict, climate extremes, economic downturns, or battling high inequality. The pandemic only exacerbated these existing challenges with significant negative effects, particularly for poor nations. Therefore, things are not going to change for better unless nations across the globe start working together.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. It could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Britain has announced the permanent deployment of two warships in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between the U.S. and China. Britain's Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the U.K. will permanently assign two ships in the region by the end of this year. He made the announcement in a joint press conference with his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo on Tuesday.
Following on from the strike group's inaugural deployment, the United Kingdom will permanently assign two ships in the region from later this year, as well as contributing a littoral response group in the coming years to come.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and it hosts the biggest concentration of U.S. military forces outside of the U.S., including ships, aircraft, and troops. The deployment would be after a strike group consisting of U.K.'s Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier and escort ships sailed through the waters in the South China Sea in September. The Queen Elizabeth is being escorted by two destroyers, two frigates, two support vessels, and ships from the U.S. and the Netherlands. It will come to Japan through the South China Sea, parts of which are claimed by China and Southeast Asian countries, with stops in India, Singapore, and South Korea. In a statement on the deployment, a Pentagon spokesperson congratulated Britain for its, quote, commitment to an interconnected network of allies and partners who mutually cooperate and support freedom of navigation and a rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific region.
These are actually illusionary entities. Yes, they have sets of laws and they are separate countries, but the globalists who run the United States and the United Kingdom work together as one entity. So what we have is two countries in which the citizens are taught from young age that they live in a sovereign state. But in fact, the two countries of the UK and the US are both under the basic control of a globalist elite.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and has, since 2014, built artificial islands on reefs and installed military bases on them. UK's Defense Secretary has said that London would also eventually deploy a littoral response group to the Pacific. That's a unit of Marines trained to undertake missions including evacuations and anti-terrorism operations.
The UK and the United States function as one entity, especially when they have a common target, which in this time is China and in a secondary level, Iran.
UK's latest policy announcements are in line with US's anti-China drive. The Biden administration's approach toward China is taking shape. Many believe Biden will continue the policies of his predecessor to contain China. While the U.S. has seemingly reduced its involvement in West Asia, the American military has sought to refocus its attention on preparing for a conflict with its major rivals, China and Russia, which it considers to be major competition in the insatiable U.S. quest for power and influence. However, Washington's economy and military power is on the wane, and whether Washington likes it or not, it has to change its warmongering policies and adopt a rather more cooperative one, something that is not likely to happen anytime soon.
The United States runs what is typically called a protection racket. You must pay to buy United States weapons and defense systems in order not to be threatened by the boogeymen that they create out of other independent countries. So the United States is always leaning on its so-called allies because, in effect, with the exception of England, with the exception of the UK, all of the other countries are military protectorates or socio-economic and military colonies of the United States.
How the Biden administration actually deals with thorny issues between the two countries is yet to be seen. It will depend on how China responds to U.S. actions. Given the strong negative public sentiments towards each other and their increasingly divergent domestic political practices, the truly benign strategic competition still remains difficult, if not impossible, to achieve.
IRIB English Radio presents Month of Velaya. The Velaya of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Sayyid Abbas Razavian.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. Welcome to the program Month of Velaya. I give you my sincere and very happy congratulations to you brothers and sisters for the joyous occasion of Eid al-Qadir. This Eid is one of the greatest Eids. When we look at the narrations, the Imams alayhi salam inform us of the sanctity of this day, of the great significance of this day. Look at some of the traditions we have from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, huwa Eidullah al-Akbar, it is narrated from him. It is the greatest Eid of Allah. وَمَا بَعَثَ اللَّهُ نَبِيًّا إِلَّا وَتَعَيَّدَ فِي هَذَا الْيَوْمِ. And every prophet appointed by Allah celebrated this day. Every prophet, when we look at the prophets of Allah, because they knew, they were giving knowledge of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, and they knew of the wilayat of Imam Ali. Every prophet celebrated Eid al-Qadir. So when we are celebrating Qadir, we are celebrating with the prophets. وَعَرَفَ هُرْمَتَ. Not only did they celebrate and know this day, but they also knew of its sanctity, how important Qadir is. When you look at some of the traditions from Imam Ridha alayhi salam, or 8th Imam, we see that he says, إِنَّ يَوْمَ الْقَدِيرِ فِي السَّمَاءِ أَشْهَرُ مِنْهُ فِي الْأَرْضِ. That the day of Qadir, the Eid of Qadir, is more known in the heavens than it is known in the earth. Because the heavens is the place where they know reality, they understand the truth of things. Therefore, even though in this world Qadir might not be well known throughout the entire world, but inshallah one day will come, just as in the heavens they celebrate Qadir, then inshallah in the world they also celebrate Qadir. Let's look at more traditions. When you compare Qadir to other Eids, like Eid al-Fitr or Eid al-Adha, or the day of Friday, the tradition says from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam that it is like comparing al-Qamar to the Kawakib. How much light does the moon have compared to the stars? This is Qadir, is the moon in terms of its light and in terms of its significance compared to the stars. We have other traditions that encourage us that it is the day of feeding others, remembering the poor. It is the day of gifts. It is the day that we give gifts to one another. Some of the cultures, they visit the Sayyids, those that are family of the Holy Prophet, those that have ancestry with the Holy Prophet. They visit them, and therefore they give gifts to one another, and they visit Sayyids. So this is something else we have in some different cultures about this day. When you look at other traditions, it is the day of fasting. Look at this tradition from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. It says, "Siyam yawm Qadir khum ya'dilu siyam umr ad-dunya." If somebody fasts on the day of Qadir, it is equivalent to fasting the time span of the entire world. How many years has the world existed? It's as if we have fasted the entire lifespan of the world. So it is the day of fasting. It is the day of congratulations and smiling. It is the day that we are happy because we are under the walayat and we have clung onto the walayat of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. Now, why is there so much emphasis for such a day? Because it is the emphasis of walayat, how important walayat is for us. Walayat is the way that we can connect to God. Walayat, the prophets and the imams, are the path to God. They teach us what to do and what not to do. They teach us what is and what is not. They teach us our beliefs. They teach us the way we should live. They teach us about how we should treat one another. And it is the way for us when you have more love and you develop more love for Ali ibn Abi Talib, when you have more love for the imams and the Holy Prophet, it is an automatic and spontaneous way to become like them. When you love something, you start to become like them. When you love Imam Ali, automatically you begin to have compassion for the orphans. You automatically begin to become just as he was a just ruler. You automatically become brave. You automatically want to spread knowledge and seek knowledge. You start developing the qualities of Imam Ali. That is maybe one of the purposes of over and over encouraging us to love the Ahlul Bayt, and also over and over encouraging us to be under the authority of the Ahlul Bayt, to accept them as our imam, because they are the path to God. They are the path to our Islamic beliefs, and they are the way and show us the way that we should live our lives. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ahl bayti tayyibin tahirin.
Mesmerizing hot air balloon festival has got on the way in the U.S. state of New Jersey. The sky was littered with nearly 100 beautifully colored hot air balloons in different shapes, captivating every viewer. The awe-inspiring event brought together COVID-wary citizens to experience joy and jubilation amid health restrictions. Pleasant weather made the experience all the more enjoyable. The 38th annual New Jersey Lottery Festival of Ballooning is likely the largest outdoor entertainment event in the tri-state area since the pandemic began.
Nostalgia is in the air in Paris as streets of the city are enlivened, that is, with old vehicles. The French capital has hosted an annual parade called Summer Crossing of Paris. It brought together over 700 vintage cars, motorbikes, buses, and tractors from all over Europe. The route started from a Vincennes castle east of Paris and ended in the southwest of the city. Drivers crossed the iconic monuments such as the Eiffel Tower and the Arc de Triomphe.
It is extraordinary because the automobile industry heritage and the Parisian architectural heritage, which is obviously absolutely fabulous, echo each other. We are driving through all of Paris's most beautiful squares.
The 14th version of the event drew hundreds of enthusiastic visitors from across France. People were asked to wear masks and keep social distancing because of COVID-19. Tehran municipality has inaugurated an art garden that puts on display Iran's art and culture. As Youssef Jalali reports, the cultural facility aims to reconnect visitors with Iran's rich past amid increasing preoccupation with modern lives.
Sit back and enjoy the beauty of Iran's ancient culture. In Kushk Art Garden, located in the heart of Tehran, visitors get to learn about Iran's music, literature, painting and calligraphy, far from the hustle and bustle of modern life. Kushk hosts Iranian artists who create masterpieces that have their roots in thousands of years ago.
Miniature painting has been around in Iran since thousands of years ago. In miniature, we paint flat images with a myriad of details. We avoid adding shades to make it as flat as possible, since in the past, Iranians believed that divine light gives shape to everything.
Metal engraving first stepped into existence 7,000 years ago in Iran. It is the art of incising decorations and metals. In this workshop, I will be available every day for visitors to see how I can turn metals into beautiful handicraft.
Kushk is part of a bigger project dubbed Art Garden. The cultural complex consists of an art lake, poem and literature house, music house, and Kushk Garden, each trying to promote an aspect of Iran's culture. Tehran municipality says it inaugurated the peaceful place, for it says cultural identity has been overshadowed by modern technology.
This precious place was a much-needed initiative to preserve the Iranian art and culture. As time goes by, technology gets more and more intertwined with our daily lives, and our genuine culture slips into oblivion. We need to have such cultural centers that safeguard our cultural heritage.
The Art Garden is situated on Abbasabad Hills in downtown Tehran. In recent years, the area has turned into a tourist attraction that houses structures that combine modern technology with ancient culture, such as this large pedestrian overpass called Tabiat Bridge, and the Middle East's largest planetarium, dubbed Mina Dome.
Kushk will be the last piece of Tehran's art garden, and will be a hotspot for a range of cultural activities, all aiming to revive the ancient Iranian art and culture, which experts believe have become a lost piece in today's hectic life. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palazzo Farnese is one of the most famous palaces in Rome and is being used as the French embassy. However, some of the rooms there are not open to the public. Now, an artist has come up with a creative way to show the historic building to everyone. An Italian artist known as JR has created a mural art installation on the French diplomatic mission in Rome. The artwork is equivalent to a virtual hole and shows what the building would look like if there were no outside walls. JR has conducted similar dazzling projects on other buildings, including a mural in the city of Florence, providing people with a sneak view of architectural masterpieces.
Cockatoos in Sydney suburbs have learned a new way to scavenge for food, opening wheelie bins with their beaks and claws. Australian researchers have found out that the parrot family birds are learning the ability from one another. Moreover, the scientists have discovered that cockatoos in different neighborhoods have distinct styles and approaches to pry open the bins. Although the birds opening bin lids seems to be a simple action, it shows a more complex behavior pattern that proves animals can learn, share, and develop subcultures. In some rural areas, online education during the pandemic seems a challenge, as students do not have access to smartphones. In the Indian state of Jharkhand, teachers have come up with an innovative idea to tackle the problem. Turning walls of houses into blackboards is the solution. Under this circumstance, students can learn in the open air while maintaining social distancing. Teachers use loudspeakers to manage the classrooms. Parents welcomed the idea, as most of them could not afford a smartphone and a fine internet connection. They also built platforms for students to sit on while attending classes. There is a famous quote: one should always try to turn every disaster into an opportunity. A Swiss hiker with Parkinson's disease has put that saying into practice by hiking more than 1,100 kilometers across the Alps. Yves Aubusson, suffering from the disease for more than 16 years, completed the challenge in less than 100 days last year. During his journey, he scaled high-altitude peaks and crossed nearly 100 mountain passes. Aubusson says his first goal was to inspire fellow patients to be active even if they are gravely affected by the incurable disease. But, he says, his major motivation was to raise awareness of the debilitating neurological illness, which is little known.
What motivated me to do this hike is that I wanted people to know better this disease that is so little known. So I did something that I think was important and that maybe people will relate to. The fact that I did this hike, some people understood it more than I hoped. It went beyond our hopes.
The 52-year-old hiker, previously a professional golfer, is now planning for a new challenge that includes a bike and a tricycle. But he believes that if he could encourage other patients to do sports, he will definitely win his challenge.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trendy news, and more from every corner of the world.
Burpees are one of the gym exercises that many consider it either a funny workout or simply avoid to do. But that's not the case with a Brazilian man who set a new Guinness World Record with 951 burpees in just 1 hour. Cassiano Rodriguez Luriano, a professional mixed martial arts fighter, completed this feat nearly a month ago that was later verified by Guinness record adjudicators. Luriano says he was driven by a promise made to his niece, Rebecca, who was born with a severe heart disease, and the gym set up a fundraising effort for her. Luriano had originally aimed for 1,000 burpees, but fallen short of that mark due to a leg injury he sustained 2 days before the feat.
I'm tired. It didn't go as smoothly as I thought it would go. I'm in so much pain now on my leg because I got hurt. But I'm very, very happy with the accomplishment and in being able to help my niece. So that's the most important thing.
Luriano has not met his family since moving to Singapore in May 2019. He says the only way he could help them is using his athleticism. The previous world record was held by a Canadian who performed 879 chest-to-ground burpees within the same time limit in March this year. In the U.S., creative designers are trying to raise awareness about the environmental issues in a fun and playful way. A climate change-themed mini golf course has recently opened to public in New York City. It consists of 18 holes, each one featuring an environmental problem or a potential solution like habitat loss, energy inefficiency, and emissions. Designed by local artists, the course is made with recycled materials.
Climate change and the environment are such important topics right now and important issues that faces all of us now and will face us in future generations. So by bringing the environmental issues to the forefront in a fun, playful way like mini golf, it really sparks the conversation and helps folks understand the scope of the issue.
Visitors have welcomed the idea, saying it's both entertaining and educational. Organizers say all of the money made from the golf course will go to two local environmental groups. Let's go to Ukraine to meet the world's oldest tennis player, who has been playing the sport for over half a century. Leonid Stanislavski, now 97 years old, has competed in various world championships. When he was a 30-year-old gymnast, he started training tennis three times a week. The Guinness World Record holder is now practicing for the 2021 Super Seniors World Championship, which will be held in Mallorca, Spain. Stanislavski believes that people can play tennis at any age.
It's an elegant type of sport. It's good physical exercise. It is a beautiful game, and there is one more thing about tennis. You can play tennis no matter what age you are.
The world's oldest tennis player revealed his secret to a long life, a combination of good genes and regular sport. His goal is to live to 100 years old and take on prominent tennis player Roger Federer. The old athlete also wishes to make a parachute jump. The largest museum in the world dedicated to the study of space has made its debut in Shanghai, China. Inspired by the orbits of celestial bodies, the layout of the building has no straight lines or right angles. The museum, designed by New York-based Anid Architects, is intended to create an immersive experience for visitors to engage in a real astronomical phenomenon. For instance, visitors can take a trip into a starry night in the optical planetarium theater.
What we aim to create is a real environment for people to look up to the starry sky. To achieve this goal, we've installed a high-precision planetarium projector at the center of the theater, which can project the sharp spots of stars on the screen with countless optical fibers. The demonstration effects are very vivid.
After moving through the museum's galleries and curved hallways, the final area visitors pass through is the sky space of the Inverted Dome. The viewing area of the Inverted Dome is about reducing almost all separation between people and the stars. The opening follows a five-year construction process in the city's Lingang district.
Every year, a lot of animals lose their life due to various kinds of accidents, but some of them are lucky enough to get a second chance. Perseus, the Greek cat, is one of them. The stray feline was taken to a vet in the city of Larissa last year after a terrible accident. The vets had to perform three surgeries, but Perseus lost the same number of limbs. However, he managed to stay alive and was given prosthetic legs. Perseus has adapted perfectly to his new limbs and now uses them to get around. He has also managed to snatch the heart of his saviors as visitors at the clinic where he cured have grown. The Japanese art collective has created a mesmerizing environment in a forest where nature and technology come together. In the mountains of Kyushu in southern Japan, the nature comes to life after the dark. Flowers and trees are illuminated in a glowing ripple shine, while rocks turn colorful with light installations. A waterfall made of light pours gently on a bright rock. Some rocks have calligraphy, and artificial pond projects colorful fish too. The artists behind the work say their aim is to unite technology and nature.
The thing is, sometimes people think it's a digital and nature is completely against each other. But in the same time, we think it's in a digital and the nature is quite easy to merge.
The Japanese team also wants to raise awareness about the original beauty of the nature, which they say is often ignored. To remind people of that, they hold exhibitions combining projections, sound, and carefully designed spaces. So far, the group has organized several art shows of this kind.
IRIB English Radio.